Business Matters, brought to you by the University of Bedfordshire Business School in partnership with Radiolab.
Thanks for everybody coming. We're recording this for Radiolab as well. We put these on the website each week as well. Want to encourage questions from people as we go along. This week, we're very, very lucky to have Mark Collier here with us from his business called Remarket Recycling.
Yes.
He'll tell us more about it in a minute. And we're going to be talking about the sort of the business of waste and recycling and what us oldies call scrap metal. But it's far more complex. We've had a very interesting discussion in the last 10 minutes, actually, which we might go over again in terms of the content and talking about the copper market. So let's kick off. So, Mark, I think if you... What I want to do is something slightly different from what we do normally is... I think we'll do a bit of a rattle through of your career with edited highlights and how you ended up where you are today, because it is quite interesting how you've done that. So I'll chip in, and anybody want to ask any questions at any time as we're going along, just please do.
Right, well, from leaving school I became a butcher because I tried to get into the army several times and couldn't do because I didn't weigh enough.
I'm right.
Too light.
Yeah. I went to be a tank driver. So I needed to be bigger, I don't know. But my father was a butcher. I'd worked with my father after school, Saturday jobs, etc. So the easy option was to just go into butchery. For a number of years, I did that. With my father, then decided to move into other areas of retail. And I've ended up selling suits, working for Debenhams, Burton's, grocery store, convenience stores, all those type of things. Women's clothes shop, and one of them in Dunstable.
Big in ladies' underwear.
In fact, in Debenhams, I once ran the lingerie department for two weeks. It was fantastic. decided that it wasn't the way to go. You do hundreds of hours for a salaried pay as a retail manager back in them days. So I looked to get out, and it was pure by accident that something happened in my flat where I needed a builder. I was moaning to him about my job, and he said, well, come and work for me. And I did a little bit of work for him, and then signed on with an agency.
Like a decorator, was it?
It was actually, he repaired drains.
Right.
And did drain block, unblocking drains and all that sort of jazz. Quite a big company in the town now. Started off as a one-man band. I signed on with an agency and actually got a posting for 6 months, if you like, on a contaminated muck site in Luton. So they were taking away arsenic and lots of other nasty stuff out of the ground. The foreman for all McAlpines that were running the site put me on the weighbridge. And at the end of the 6 months, I applied for a weighbridge job in a waste company, which...
Do you want to explain what a weighbridge is?
Okay, basically it's the platform the wagon lorry pulls on, full of its rubbish, press the buttons and it weighs it, produces a ticket. They empty the lorry out and then bring it back on and press another button that tells you how much waste they've actually tipped.
Right.
So I ended up doing that for a couple of years. Wanted to move on. Unfortunately, it was a company that was... It was quite a large company, but it was a family-run business. And I was actually told by one of the directors that the only way you'll get any promotion here is if one of us dies. So I answered an advert in the paper for a weighbridge person in a scrapyard and got an interview. During that interview, it was stopped halfway through. And the managing director actually said to me, actually, no, we don't think you're right for this job. Can you come back tomorrow? So quizzically, all right then. And I went back with intrepidation and was offered the job as a trainee trader.
Right.
And then obviously I took that job because saw it as a progression. And at a time, scrap metal was on its backside, really. It was in a real doldrums. I've come out of a growing business into a fading one, but it wasn't like that, thankfully. So I spent 6 months working in the scrapyard. I spent 6 months working in a shipping department, learning all about letters of credit and so forth. 6 months in accounts, and then 6 months on the trading floor to earn my wings as a trader for this company. We were the third biggest metal recyclers in the in Europe at the time.
Okay, so before we go any further, can you say a bit more about trading? So you were, you've been recruited as a trainee trader, and you did, as you said, 6 months on the trading floor. What do we mean by the trading floor? What do we mean by trading in this
situation? That was to contact potential customers with a view to buying their material, and then you would go through a process. You would buy physical material. Somebody else in the office, more senior at the time, would then collate everything that's been bought in on paper and then sell into whatever contract abroad. Mostly at the time was India. It was a very big market, the Indian market. And then trade then on the London Metal Exchange. So you would offset your buying or selling through paper exercise, if you like.
Right, so just to be clear, so you were, where was this business based? Is that in Luton?
It was in Bedfordshire.
In Bedfordshire. Yeah. So you're in Bedfordshire and you're ringing up clients, customers, mm-hmm. saying, basically, have you got anything that I can buy? Or do you, were you specifically saying, I'm really keen on getting some copper or some lead or...
Yeah, you'd...
It's just metals, was
it? You'd do your research.
It would just be metals?
Yeah. And non-ferrous. We didn't touch ferrous metals.
Right.
At all. It was basically a non-ferrous operation.
Right.
So your aluminium, brass, copper, lead, etc. Not steel or iron. You would just contact somebody like myself to buy volume. We didn't have a door trade, so we wouldn't have a plumber walking in with a 10-kilo bag of copper. Right. It was purely... volume.
We so who would be in. Selling this to you? Who would your
that would it, who it would be larger be larger scrap metal merchants. So
other scrap
like metal. Myself, somebody who could supply 25 tons of X material or right. mixed material, whatever the case would be.
So your business therefore was trying to make a turn on these
on these
transactions. Buy. You're getting together, you're consolidating really, I suppose.
Yeah.
Smaller amounts into larger amounts, which you could sell at
obviously
advantageous prices.
As with anything, with bulk, you can command more money. So
right.
The idea was to bulk it all up and then sell it abroad, mostly India in those days. Yeah, then working for that company, I then started up a catalytic converter recycling business for them.
Explain to the ladies and gentlemen what a catalytic converter is.
catalytic converters... a device that's fitted to your car to lessen the emissions.
Yep.
Contains precious metals, platinum, palladium and rhodium.
Right.
You have a monolith block inside, which through a process the metal can be extracted. At the time then, I was buying in thousands, and I did a lot of business with Johnson Matthey, pharmaceutical company, but also they manufacture catalytic converters.
So right.
They were taking old to process to extract the metals to start again.
And these catalytic converters were coming out of cars being scrapped or do they have a natural life after being replaced
contact,
in the car?
Car breakers, vehicle dismantlers, exhaust centres, anywhere that would be likely to take an exhaust off a car.
Right.
Yeah, again, that was just a bulk and storage. At the time, we used to process, so we would process it down to a dust ourselves. And then I would then sell the monolith dust onto.
Oh well, so you put them in some sort of like
furnace system.
Some grinder thing or something to, or crusher
or
whatever.
Yeah, just smash it. A ball mill.
Smash it up
normally. it does. It's just like a massive
really?
Ball bearing in a. If you imagine a giant cement mixer,
right?
And this ball bearing just as it keeps going round just grinds it all down and crushes it.
Oh well, right. Okay.
Then it's ready for furnace.
Yeah.
Which is another. Complicated process. Takes about 6 weeks for the rhodium to come out, 2 weeks for platinum and palladium. So that's quite a long process.
Yeah.
But yeah, from starting that business, then through various people telling me that I should do it myself, I then had a customer that I used to buy non-ferrous metals from for that side of the business, then encouraged me to walk away and set up a business with him. And the idea was to set up a partnership whereby we offered a complete service. So, we went out and bought a plastic grinding machine to grind up car bumpers and things like that for the polypropylene bumpers, and we set about it in quite a big way. Unfortunately, his business was built by his father. He'd inherited it from his father's death, and I don't think he realised the amount of work that we was going to put in to a new business. And I was going away collecting, gaining business, having the stuff delivered, and all this stuff would be sitting outside, no processing done, no nothing. The idea was, as I found the work, he provided the labour for the process, because he had labour in his building anyway. And being on a private industrial estate, you then start to get complaints, because we had all this materials that sitting outside. We sat down, had a chat. I actually said to him, I'm frightened to go out and get new business. And he said, I don't think my heart's in this. And it was a case of just walking away.
Right.
And then I knew somebody that ran a car breaking business that offered me a piece of yard to work in, and a dilapidated brick building as an office. And so that was me on my own, just contacted again all the catalytic converter people, and built the business on catalytic converters.
Right.
That was the main core of the business.
So you were working just by yourself?
On my own, one man in a van. The company that I'd been working for as a trader and set up the catalytic side for them, they actually employed, we had nine depots, and they employed one person from eight depots with a van, and two people from our head office, which is where I'd come from, with vans to go out and beat me on price and everything, and wipe me out, so to speak, because I'd set up in competition.
So you were in direct competition with them?
Direct, yeah.
Right.
Business Matters, brought to you by the University of Bedfordshire Business School in partnership with Radiolab.
So you started up your business 12 years ago.
Yeah.
And your first job was to repel the boarders, if you like, the your ex-employers, who were a bit miffed, I suppose, a bit disappointed that you'd set up in competition with them.
The one thing that really struck me, when I handed my notice in, I was left for 2 weeks sitting at a desk, and all I did was contact every customer that I'd bought catalytic converters from, and said, if if I was on my own, would you sell them to me, etc. And everybody said, we do anyway. So
because they saw that they were dealing with you rather than with a company.
The company, yeah. It was quite a personal thing, I suppose. And I was quite, I think, eventually when they cottoned on what I was doing. For the first 6 weeks working in Bishop Stortford, they wouldn't really have cottoned on at all. It was only when it was me on my own. And I think that miffed them. It's a bit silly, because employers should have stuff in place.
Yeah,
I do.
Exactly.
And I'm just a small company.
Yeah. So what was it? Okay. So with one of your guys, sort of handing in his notice this afternoon, what would you do then if he was in? Somebody who you thought could go
off. It's actually we do have contracts in place whereby they're not allowed to set up in direct competition, etc.
Now, 12 months or something.
You can't stop anybody, but if we needed to, we could go down a process that would halt it.
But presumably you'd walk them out the door, show them out the door that day, would you? Before they had the opportunity to...
Well, it depends who they are.
Right.
If it was works manager, he'd have to go straight away.
Yeah.
Obviously to protect what we have, etc. And he's got sets of keys and things like that. If it's just one of the guys who is processing, I think depending on how I viewed them and their character, it's only happened once, so touch wood.
Yeah. So when you were sort of left in the lurch by your business partner there in Bishop Stortford, you were married,
had a daughter, yep.
So what was the reaction at home when you came home and said, here we are.
Come home, I said, I've got a month's money. And my wife said, but I need that to, for food, bills, etc. And I actually said to her, right, okay, give me a month. I'll use this salary, this month's money. Give me a month to use that to buy converters with. And if I can't replace it at the end of that month, I'll go and get a job. Because I could have walked into any metal recyclers. During my first month, I was actually contacted by a firm in London, contacted by a young lady who was the first ever woman trader on the LME, and she actually said her father had spoken to her and to give me the message, if you like, that if it doesn't go right, then go banging on his door.
He would have me.
Another, probably now left the biggest family-run independent scrap merchants in the country. They offered me help, but obviously that was with a view to making sure that they bought all the material that I was buying. So I politely declined, but we did do some business, so that was nice just to keep a hand in. So yeah, basically it was a make or break for that month.
Okay.
I applied for a bank loan, which took 4 months to actually get.
But you did get it?
I did get it.
Right.
I never used it.
Okay.
I had it put into a separate account, and at the end, I think the loan was for 5 years, and at the end of the 5 years, the money was still sitting there.
And what was the security on your loan?
We used it as savings.
What was the security that they asked for on that loan?
There wasn't none.
No security?
No.
It's interesting because we had a manager from Barclays sitting in this seat talking about startup businesses and lending money, and he's a very experienced guy. He relayed one or two stories about how somebody come in a bit like yourself and in a different type of business and asked for a loan and had no security, but something he could sense somehow that this particular guy was going to be successful or whatever, despite the fact that he didn't have any sort of assets or any particular track record running his own business. And indeed, lent him £5,000 or whatever it was.
I think now it is harder. I regularly get surveys from the Federation of Small Businesses, and they are always asking about finance. Have you tried to gain any finance? How easy was it? But I don't do it now. Everything, the only thing we owe is the mortgage on the building that we're currently in.
Right.
All machinery, everything's bought and paid for. I ran it from day one that way. If I needed something, if I could afford to get it, I'd get it. Maybe sometimes it was a stretch because you're looking to, okay, I need this piece of machinery in order to move to the next stage of the business, etc. But always make sure that we owned, so that we have assets. And I haven't got debts falling around the years. But that's the way the scrap metal business did work prior to legislation change. It was a cash business. You bought your stuff, you paid for it, you sold your stuff, you got your money. There's no 30-day invoices,
right.
Nothing like that. It's virtually instant. I've sold this morning, next Tuesday, the money will be in my account.
Right.
Not like a business anywhere else where you send out invoices and then chase a month later for the money. So when it comes to buying machinery, etc., if I can buy that piece of machinery, I just buy it.
Because starts paying for itself straight away.
I've got an invoice, etc., and no one can take it away then.
Okay.
Business Matters, brought to you by the University of Bedfordshire Business School in partnership with Radiolab.
So you've got the business and you've got it going. I won't take you through the whole, or you won't take us through the whole, the following 12 years, but what I wanted to move on to. So it's quite interesting to hear the story of how you end up starting your own business. But what we're also interested is, how does the scrap metal business work? How does the industry work? So maybe you could tell us how it worked when you were, just yourself in a van, quite small, and how it's a bit different now that you're obviously a much bigger business than you were. So where were you? So you were initially buying catalytic converters, sort of recycling those. When did you sort of then broaden that out into other metals and so on?
Within about 12 months, I then decided that obviously there was the experience there dealing with non-ferrous metals, so it would be much better to use that experience and then obviously buy non-ferrous and CAT converters. The idea at the time was that the price of catalytic converters dipped, not the non-ferrous would support it.
Yep.
Now it's completely the other way around. The CAT converter business has changed that much that I don't chase the business in the same way anymore. I don't go around the country collecting. It either comes to me or it doesn't.
I suppose that's the point, isn't it? Initially, you were a one-product business.
Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously, that's fine. We're not past that. The market prices are higher, whatever it is, or the supply is good. But it's very risky, obviously.
Very.
Whereas if you broaden the portfolio to to other metals, other products, you've got more balance.
Yeah, see, the pricing for non-ferrous metals and the pricing for catalytic converters are two different sides. Because one is obviously cat converters containing the platinum group metals. Prices on that don't necessarily follow prices based on London Metal Exchange non-ferrous prices.
Yeah.
Non-ferrous can dip, and the PGM market can actually come up. So it was there to support
without
having the two, you know, two fall flat on their backsides or be doing really well. It was at that point when I decided to do that that I then realised I was a little bit hindered by my friend's business, if you like, in his car breakers, because his workers wouldn't recognise another business in there, which, rightly so, in one respect, they needed to get on with their job. And it was at that point that I then started to look for our own premises, which took 2 years further. Yeah, after year three, we moved into our own premises, which is probably the biggest headache I've ever had in running a business. Finding the premises was easy. I had to apply for a change of use, so go for a planning application, which took from the March until the August to get sorted out. It was one of the biggest headaches. I went to County Hall in Bedford. I was at the time sat with two planning officers with my application that needed to be submitted there and then and paid for there and then. I had three questions on the planning form that I couldn't fill out. I couldn't make head or tail of them. And when I asked, they actually said they didn't know how to fill the form out. I remember leaving the office, getting into my van. My wife rang me and said, right, so what is the change of use on this building? I said, I don't know. She said, what do you mean you don't know? I said, they don't know either. I need to sit here on my own now for 10 minutes because my head was spinning. And the whole future depended really upon this planning application. Right at the last minute, as you all know, when an application is put in and there's a deadline for people to object, etc., the day after the last date for objections, somebody objected and the council took it seriously. I spent the whole weekend worrying about it. I then emailed them on the Monday morning with a list of costs. Bought Ford truck, paid £5,000, whatever, solicitors' fees, etc. Totaled it all up and then told them I would sue them because they've taken an objection after the deadline.
Yeah.
Within 2 hours of sending that email, had the planning permission, which is a bit weird. That was a good feeling because it's sort of the little guy against the council comes through and wins.
Yeah.
So we moved into our own premises. I worked in my own, in that premises, opening in it, going off, locking it back up and going off collecting converters from around the country, coming back and then hoping plumbers would walk in with bags of copper or whatever.
So talk us through a plumber walking in with a bag of copper.
Basically, they pull up, they'll come in and say,
so they have a cylinder,
and we basically put it on the scale and weigh it accordingly. Some plumbers will have nice clean stuff, and
that's what I was going to ask. Quality and so on?
We have grades. If you take typical plumbing scrap, you have brazery copper and what we now call heavy copper or 98% copper. So the 98% will not contain any brass. The brazery will, as long as it's not heavy taps, etc. If it's brass nuts,
how can you tell which is which?
Valves. Well, you see the brass.
You can see it.
But some plumbers will come in and say, I've got this heavy copper here, and throw it on the scale when you look in the bag and it's full of brass.
Right.
And then they might argue that, actually, no, that's, you know, but most are okay, honestly. And most do know, they are quite educated.
So they bring in, I don't know, what, 10, 20 kilos or whatever of copper, or would it be a lot more than that?
It varies.
And
also,
so
it depends on them, because sometimes you have some plumbers that will store their stuff for X amount of time.
Right.
I can remember the first Christmas in the new building, this guy turned up in a quite a large van with a van load full of bags of copper and copper cylinders, so immersion heaters.
Yeah.
And we unloaded him, and he said, right, I've got to go back and get the next load. He did three loads all on that one morning, which... it was great because it was just by Christmas, everyone's shutting down and I'm sitting there with a building full of copper. From a security point of view, it's not brilliant.
No, absolutely. So I was going to ask about that. So he comes along with, you know, a van or three loads worth of copper, three vans worth of copper. Are you obliged to take it? It's your business. So you can say, you have to wait till after Christmas, mate, or whatever.
Yeah.
But if you do take it, is that cash? So would you be paying cash for that copper?
At the time, that was cash, but no longer. Cash is now illegal in the scrap metal business. Yeah.
Oh, we'll come back to that in a second. Okay, so you'd have paid cash for these three van loads of copper, which, as you say, would be sitting in your yard or whatever.
So I've got the security
for a couple of weeks
aspect of it. Yeah. And then also...
And then what would do with it?
Well, we would process... If it's got brass, brass attachments, we would cut the brass off. Brass would go in one bin, sold as brass.
Right.
Or in international terms, they call it honey. And the copper tubing would then... go into another bin and be sold as a separate grade.
And how often would you... So who would you sell it to? And how often would you do that?
Depending on where we're going, it can be an end user, so a smelter, someone who's going to melt it down straight away and remake whatever, so they're completing the recycling process. We can go through bigger yards, sort of more international known scrap merchants, who may have a contract to fulfill with a company in China, so then they could be offering out certain prices that are perhaps better. So it's either end users or like a brokerage system,
right,
if you like.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we ship out once a week. I've shipped out for probably the last 5-6 years, which is quite good, because only being a small building.
Yeah.
But then also, you see, that's quite advantageous. Lots of people will say you need a bigger boat. Lots of customers say that you need a bigger premises. And I said no, because then you keep it, you store more.
Yeah.
One, the security. Two, the price goes down, so you're holding on to material that, you know, during the recession.
So you're forced to be efficient.
Get it in, clean it up, get it into the quality that a smelter end user would expect, get it out.
Okay.
Roll the money over. It's the same attitude from day one. Buy, roll your money over, take your profit, and then buy the next lot.
We've only got 5 or so minutes to go, I'm surprised to see.
Blimey.
I want to open it up to the floor in terms of any questions for Mark on anything really, on small business, scrap metal dealing, whatever.
So would it just be plumbers coming to you, or do you have actual individual people coming to you as well?
We do have householders. And occasionally we do get a householder will ring up and say, look, we've got this copper, we've had our heating changed, and we've got the copper from the old heating system, but we don't want the plumber to take it. Can you tell me how much it's worth? And then they'll bring it down themselves. So we do have householders. I deal with people from household, from trades, so plumbers, builders, etc. Factories, I deal with places that make stuff for Formula One, the space shuttle. So it's a very broad customer base, very, very broad. One minute I can be talking to a traveller, the next minute I'll be talking to the managing director of an aerospace manufacturer. Makes it interesting.
Do you have a plan or a strategy that says, you know, in 5 years' time, I want my business to like this?
I've always had a plan from day one, because obviously when I went through applying for the bank loan system, you have to submit your business plan, etc. And I've always kept to a plan, and it is, funnily enough, 5 years ahead.
Yeah.
Growth is something that for me is very important, because even if we don't, I've got to look to grow to keep the company healthy. The way I look at it, I employ people. So I have to look. I'm looking after their own well, but keep their jobs, etc. You've got to have a plan. You've got to look to the future. What's going to happen here? And obviously, with our type of business, with commodity markets being very volatile, you look ahead to see, you know, what is. It's sort of natural in a way. But I do have written plans.
Business Matters. Brought to you by the University of Bedfordshire Business School in partnership with Radiolab.
I wanted to ask if there are like three sort of golden rules or golden nuggets that you've learnt. Good word for a scrap metal dealer. In terms of starting up your own business and making a success of your own business, in case there's anybody here who might want to do the same sort of thing, either in this industry or another one, what would they be?
I suppose the first one would be, if you have an idea and you think it can work, try it. I have a saying, I tell all my employees, nobody drowned from getting into water. They just got drowned by staying in that water. So if you don't try, you don't know at the end of the day. If you have that drink, go for it. If you try and fail, then you tried.
What attributes do you think a person needs to be successful?
I think you've got to have integrity, be honest, come across in that way and show it, be sincere. People sell to people. It's any business, really. You're dependent upon whether it be suppliers or services that you put out. People buying from you, you buying from them. So you've got to have that honesty and integrity, yep. Sincerity. And the other thing really is just hard work. Yeah. The willingness to keep going, not be disheartened, crack on with it, I suppose.
How many employees have you got?
No? I employ 4 full-time, 2 part-time.
Okay. If you had a vacancy, one of your guys left, or you were growing the business as a sort of, I don't know, a trainee person or whatever, of some sort, in the business, what would you be looking for? You know, if somebody here was thinking of coming along for an interview sort of thing, what would be the key things you'd be looking for a new recruit, assuming you didn't need prior experience?
Most of them, not anybody has had prior experience. When I've interviewed people, I look at how they come across. If I think they're honest and sincere, trustworthy, trust in my business is a massive thing for me, down to the employees, our customers, the people we sell to. They trust that everything's going to have the right quality, etc. Trust is a massive thing. If you sort of click with those people at interview, then we tend to follow the instinct on them.
Right. Okay. Which, interesting.
Yeah, it's not. We don't need masses of qualifications, etc. But then obviously if I was looking for a trader to go off all over the Europe or you know, the America, Asia, wherever, then perhaps I'd look for a few more qualifications than the lads have now.
Yeah. But, all right. Any last questions? Yes.
So if someone's interested in working in the scrap metal business, what advice would you give them?
Or working within the industry?
Yeah, so let's say they're just interested in working with scrap metal business, but they don't know where to start.
I would say contact as many companies in the industry, or even a good point would be the British Metals Recycling Association, which is like our trade body, to talk to as many people as possible, because there are so many different areas of the industry you could actually go into, get a feel of what it is you think you want to do, where, how you want to fit in into what area, and then chat to as many people as possible, get as much information as possible. If it's by yourself, then you need to go down council routes for licensing, etc., etc. Environment agency licenses through them. That's all a very time consuming process, and one that will give you a headache, guarantee it.
But you wouldn't advise someone to start up necessarily a scrap metal business from scratch, as opposed to getting on working for one initially and get a real feel for the business.
You need to gain experience. If you think, for somebody to set up without any knowledge whatsoever, you could go out and spend a lot of money and lose it very quickly, because if the markets change quickly like they have been, even with catalytic converter, if you take a platinum market, say on one day you can have £1,000 a troy ounce for platinum, the next morning it could be 800. And if you've bought at the higher price, or against that higher price, then you've lost the margin overnight. And the market now is very much like that. When I first started in the game, it used to be close of play, unofficial price. When you came in the morning, you could guarantee it would start off on the same footing, and then trade throughout the day, so you'd watch the market rise, fall, whatever the case may be. Whereas now it's virtually a 24-hour market, because the Shanghai Stock Exchange, the American Exchange, it's all now intermingled. So you can actually walk away at night time and having spent X amount of pounds and then coming in the morning and it's not worth it. So you do need some knowledge, unless you're a man driving around in a truck just picking up rubbish.
Right, good. I think we're going to wind up there. So thanks very much, Mark. It's been a...
Thank you.
Well, I've learned a lot. I suspect everybody else has as well. So that's been really good. So thanks very much for that. So that's it. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
For more information, visit radiolab.beds.ac.uk/businessmatters.